I am joined today by the Tesla Quartet. They are a string quartet that has been in existence for about 10 years. I'm so happy to have you all on the show today. It's great to have four musicians, the entire quartet. Can you all introduce yourselves and tell us which instrument you play?
Hi, I'm Ross Snyder, and I play violin.
And this is Michelle Lee. I also play violin.
My name is Serafim. I play the cello.
And I'm Edwin Kaplan, and I play the viola.
Now, you established the quartet in 2008 at the Juilliard School. How did you all decide to come together as a group?
Well, actually, I'm the only surviving member from that original quartet.
Surviving?
Surviving, yes. I've managed to stay afloat. This is Ross. I was a graduate student at Juilliard at the time, and met three other wonderful musicians, and we put the quartet together. A year after that, we moved to Colorado to study with the Takacs Quartet, and while we were there, Michelle joined the group. She was doing a doctorate at Indiana at the time, and it was kind of perfect timing for her to jump into a new project. We invited her to join the quartet. She and I actually knew each other from studying at the New England Conservatory a number of years before. So we played for a number of years in that configuration, and then 2013, Edwin came and auditioned for the group, and relatively soon after that, he introduced us to Serafim, who was a friend of his, and they had played some chamber music together on and off in New York City, where they were both living at the time. So since early 2014, we've been in this current configuration.
And your namesake is Nikola Tesla. What inspired you to take his name?
Well, this is Edwin speaking. The one of the great things about Nikola Tesla that we appreciate so much is that he had a desire to bring people together, bring communities together, and connect. And that's a lot of his work is in harnessing the electromagnetic power of the earth and sharing electricity with and making it available widely and cheaply. So when we were looking for a name and, you know, finding inspiration in somebody like this, I think we were able to find a parallel between what we do and what he does. Certainly the idea of tapping into an emotional force, an unseen force, and transmitting it and communicating it to an audience in a way that brings us all together is something that we find in common with Nikola Tesla, and it's a huge honor and privilege to be named after such a great mind.
Yeah, we also, you know, it just reminded me that as a quartet, we like to find these hidden gems or pieces that are often, you know, forgotten or overlooked, and Nikola Tesla was kind of a figure also was pretty underappreciated, I feel like, until very recently, the car blow up, of course. So I think that there is another parallel to it.
And you've been together as a group for 4 years now, you just told me. So there are a lot of challenges today, I would think, as performing as a string quartet. I mean, there are many out there, quite a bit of competition when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. correct.
Yep.
So what do you do to make your group special and stand out and survive as an ensemble where you can perform together on a regular basis?
You know, we don't necessarily like to think of ourselves as special in a way. We find ways to have interesting and innovative programs, and our audience usually gets really interested in the pieces that they perhaps wouldn't have listened to. We play, actually, the album is a perfect testament to that. We pair composers from different eras together and find these interesting connections between them. And the best way we find to talk about ourselves is basically just using the feedback we get from our audience. And I was just recently talking to somebody who compared us to a synchronized swimming team. And he's an athlete, and I was very curious about that comparison. He said, you know, you guys just have that unity, that beautiful beauty in the symmetry that just kind of reminded him of a athletic group, athletic ensemble. And so we often hear things like energy, captivating, you know, things like that. So we do our best. We love playing. We are very passionate. We take a lot of pride in what we do. And we also recognize there are wonderful ensembles, our colleagues. We don't necessarily think of them as our competitors. I think there's enough place for a lot of great musicians in the world, and we don't necessarily feel threatened by it.
And this is your debut album, but you've been performing all over the world for many years. What made you decide that this was the right time for a recording like this?
As a group forms and develops and we learn each other, there definitely comes a point when it feels like there's a certain amount of gelling that we're doing that may have taken a while to get to or something, but it definitely feels like, I mean, we're all itching to put stuff onto a CD, and so it feels like we've just gotten to a point where the quartet is really starting to show an identity for itself, and the four of us are working very well together. And the fact that this 10-year anniversary is coming up for the quartet in its long-term career, it just seems like a really perfect opportunity and a coincidence or a confluence of good fortune.
And it also has to do with in some practical matters too. I mean, in case some listeners are unfamiliar how the recording industry works, it's really a shifting field at this moment, and it's rare that artists or quartets sign record deals. I mean, you've got to be quite elite to get those kinds of things. And so a lot of quartets our age are producing their music on their own, fundraising through various sources, and hiring a team to do the recording, and all of that money comes up front. And so we were fortunate to have a residency at the time when we did this recording, and a residency at a small university up in Canada that had a budget not only for salaries but for professional development. And so we decided that this was the right time. As Edwin was saying, we were itching to do this recording, and then the financial aspect came along with it as well. I think just the everything coming together at that time a couple of years ago when we were making the plans was really fortunate. So I think we would have done it sooner, but these events kind of came together at the right moment for us.
Let's get into the repertoire a little bit more. You mentioned the variety. You've got Haydn, Ravel, and Stravinsky. And I understand you started out thinking about the Haydn and building around that. Of course, he wrote so many string quartets. What was your reasoning in picking the one that you did by Haydn and then going off on a little bit of a tangent here with Ravel and Stravinsky?
Well, I don't know if we would call the Ravel and the Stravinsky as actually a tangent or as tangential as you might suggest. The Haydn is a strong work that comes after a long period of development in his own compositional style. He had already gone through several phases at that point with the development of the string quartet, and as you said, he's viewed as sort of the father of the string quartet, having written so many. But his first major set where he really gets to show off his skills, the Opus 20s, were definitely in experimental. And I mean, he's always experimental, but he was experimenting with forms that were both old and new for him at the time. And then the same thing with his next set, Opus 33s. There's this tendency towards innovation, and so each step along the way he develops more and more. And I think we felt that this particular Opus 54 number 2 represented a coming into his own for Haydn, and I think we felt that also about ourselves too, so it seemed like a nice fit. And as far as the Ravel and the Stravinsky, trying to trying to find connections to Haydn, it's not too much of a stretch to see how Ravel and Stravinsky were both looking into the past for inspiration and looking towards their classical predecessors and thinking in a sort of newly classical way or a neoclassical way about their own expressions and how far they could take their own ideas. So certainly we can, the Ravel is a wonderful centerpiece of the album, and his minuet that was dedicated to Haydn's name shows a certain love and appreciation for Haydn's music that we can see in his approach to structure and style. And Stravinsky certainly is not distant from that process either, since Stravinsky and Ravel were both friends, and Stravinsky is known to have been somebody who looked to the past for inspiration. Even his title, concertino, is a classical word. It's a word that fits very well in the classical era, and he's repurposing it for a new 20th century expression. But we would consider both of these composers as having neoclassical perspectives.
And you mentioned more about the Ravel. You've got a couple of pieces of piano music that were arranged, correct, Ross, for this album?
Right.
So what made you choose those pieces? I know the one, obviously, in honor of Haydn, but do you feel that all of those pieces kind of tie that relationship together between Haydn and Ravel?
Yeah. So the Menuet Antique is one of Ravel's earliest works, and the fact that he's already considering it something old-fashioned, this antique that he is perhaps repurposed and polished up a little and is displaying on his, you know, credenza or something. I think that kind of goes along with the whole looking to the past for inspiration bit of the album. And even the really tiny C-sharp minor minuet was actually kind of an exercise for him in demonstrating to a student how you can write with concision and still express something meaningful. And Haydn, I think, in a way, also embodies that, that Haydn, especially from his Opus 50 and Opus 54 sets, can take the ideas that have accumulated over time and condense them into a succinct way of expressing musical ideas. So I think that's kind of how they all relate. And the fact that we have them interspersed throughout the album helps to link across time and across style.
Well, and obviously you enjoy playing the music of Ravel, and it's interesting that he wrote just the one quartet. Is that disappointing to you, members of a string quartet, that he only wrote one of them?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the impetus for making these arrangements in the first place, is that he's one of my favorite composers, and there's not a whole lot. I mean, his output is relatively small. And with only one string quartet, I thought I could take it upon myself to create a little bit more of his music for quartet. It's a hobby of mine, I suppose. So, yeah, I'm glad that now we have more Ravel to play as a quartet.
And the Stravinsky, you mentioned it's from his neoclassical period, which many of our listeners will be familiar with. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what our listeners can hear in that work? And it may not be what they're expecting, you know, like some of his other big orchestral works, of course.
Yeah. It's so this is Serafin speaking, and I'm really excited about the way this Stravinsky came out in our album. We, of course, think of ways how the string quartet sound is just so incredibly malleable and so diverse. And for the listeners who might be just familiar with the basic string quartet repertoire, of course they will feel right at home with Haydn, and perhaps even Ravel, that it's more familiar piece. But Stravinsky is just such an incredibly vibrant and intense piece. It has been received with sort of a similar reaction than the Rite of Spring, Rite of Spring made. I remember reading about people saying it was just very kind of coarse and explosive and strange and weird. And I think it's just incredible what he's able to achieve using so few tools. He doesn't use the full orchestra, he doesn't use percussion, but yet it's at times it reminds of his orchestral writing. And we were even experimenting with microphone placement. Our wonderful recording engineer Simon Eden and producer Andrew Keener were extremely risk-taking in trying to find unique sound for each piece. And for if you will skip to Stravinsky right after listening to Ravel, I think it will strike you how different they sound. It's almost like a different quartet playing. We had a very close microphone, which means that we were capturing a lot of really intense kind of close sound. And yeah, I think it works really well, really beautifully, and we just can't wait for people to hear it.
What can we expect to hear from Tesla moving forward?
Well, we are very excited to educate. I shouldn't say educate, it's such a kind of boring word. We'd like to introduce a lot of people to new music, perhaps the music that hasn't been in the focus as much. For example, we are working, actually just today, we're about to rehearse this piece by Villa-Lobos, the Brazilian composer. Your listeners might be familiar with his Bahianas. And he wrote, believe it or not, 17 string quartets. And
I don't think I've ever heard one of them.
Yeah.
Except for this one.
Yeah. So, and the 17 is actually his last quartet. His last quartet he wrote. And we have this really cool program. I think it's very cool. Program idea, which is last works by the composers. And it's Beethoven's Opus 135, his late quartet, written just basically months before his passing. And then we have Villa-Lobos quartet number 17 and Britten's number 3. And it's not necessarily a very traditional string quartet program, but I think our audience might be just getting this a little extra interesting hook that, ooh, these are the works that composers wrote shortly before they died. And it's such an interesting concept to think about. So that's kind of maybe in the core of our identity, is to thinking how can we be more innovative with our programming.
Well, if you stay tuned with the string Tesla Quartet, next year we'll be releasing another album with clarinist Alex Fitterstein, where we recorded works by Mozart and other great works as well. So please stay tuned.
It sounds great. Well, this is members of the Tesla Quartet joining me here on WCVE Music. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having us.